Welcome to AIM on Air, the official podcast of the Association for Intelligent Information Management. Founded in 1944, AIM is dedicated to advancing the information management industry. We represent a vibrant global community of information leaders committed to driving exceptional business outcomes through information management fueled by technology like AI and automation. You can learn more at AIIM.org. I'm AIM President and CEO, Tori Miller-Liu, and I am delighted to welcome today's guest. He is currently the Senior M365 Information Governance Architect in North America for Infotection, and he's previously worked with Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield as a Senior Solutions Architect and Pentraffic as Manager of Network and Database Services. He has expertise in metadata, enterprise content, data warehousing, database administration, and information management. And I intentionally left off like 10 other things because the list was getting so long. Okay. He has also been a member of AIM for years and is an AIM certified information professional. Please join me in welcoming Peter Rahalski. Peter, it's so nice to have you on the show.
So nice to be here, Tori. Glad to join you for this conversation.
And I've been
looking forward to it all week.
I was looking forward to it too, especially after I like looked at your LinkedIn bio, and I wasn't exaggerating. I mean, there were so many specialties on there, and I know some of it was more of a broad knowledge, but it was hard to just pick a few that I felt would be most relevant to this audience. You've had quite an expansive career, everything from app development to telecoms to information management. So let's start there. You have had this very diverse career in technology. What sort of directed you towards information management? What was that progression like? And what interests you in information management?
So I started out a long, long time ago in software development, back when mainframes were the most common platform for doing software development. And eventually, spent some time in consulting, ended up in as a database administrator, and worked for a number of years in that area, and ended up building a team of technical support specialists for a large regional retailer based in Syracuse, where I live, eventually ended up with the health plan, kind of doing the same kind of thing, because I'd spent a lot of time doing business intelligence and data warehousing. And so I ended up with the health plan there. And about, I'm going to say almost 10 years ago, in my role as a solution architect, I got involved with this decision for the organization on what we were going to do about jumping into the digital workplace. And so we went through this whole evaluation, of the platforms that were available at the time, and finally chose one. And then the CIO left the company, and so the project was put on hold. And in the lurch, I ended up becoming an ECM admin. So we brought in an ECM solution. I ended up building that solution, and that's actually when I got involved with AIM, was somewhere around that same time. I wanted to learn more about information management, because that was really becoming kind of like my focus within the organization. And I ended up being basically, the internal subject matter expert on all things related to information management for the company. That led eventually to, so when they finally got going on the digital workplace, they came back to me because I had the most subject matter expertise on how to manage information. And so I ended up basically moving into the role of architecting our entire Microsoft environment. And I did that for a few years and then ended up at Infotection. And I've been there for a little bit over 2 years now.
Wow. Okay. So you are incidentally confirming my theory that the majority of information management practitioners got there via a project.
Yeah. Yeah. probably, I mean, in both cases, you know, the idea of moving to digitization was put me in that direction. And then finally, you know, taking over responsibility for managing what we were doing when it came to, you know, as a health plan, we were managing literally hundreds of millions of documents for our members. And I ended up being in a position where I built a new platform for doing that, migrated everything off the old platform, and ultimately consolidated down from three platforms to one in the process. And largely that was a technical thing, you know, because I actually managed the infrastructure and everything. But ultimately, I just needed to have all that expertise in order to make really good decisions about what was going to be best for the business.
Yeah, you have to, I learned that myself in my previous roles when I was implementing data warehouses and data lakes. You have to kind of, it's not enough to understand the engine. You have to understand the fuel, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We had to understand a lot about what was necessary, what we were trying to meet from a business perspective. You know, what were the real pain points for the business coming out of where they were.
Yeah.
And how we could basically improve the process for our clients, you know, our customers, which was in this case a health plan's members.
Yeah. I think that's a great example of why, since you're a certified information professional, you'll know this, business analysis is actually a part of our CIP credential. You need to be able to analyze business requirements, dissect the requirements, and be able to implement solutions, which is very much the role of a business analyst, right?
Yeah, it is. You know, to a large degree, you know, we didn't necessarily have those people involved in a lot of that process, so I had to learn a lot of that on my own. But it was a good way to get grounded in, you know, the organization as a whole was really kind of turning things around and saying that IT, generally speaking, had to be more business focused and come at everything from the perspective of the business. So it was an easy transition because the organization really supported that.
So can you talk a little bit more about what that looks like? So if you're, how important was leadership support in that transformation?
In the case of where I was at the time, you know, we really, what happened in terms of the IT organization was this focus on how we provided value to the organization rather than just basically built systems. And so the idea of understanding what created value in the organization started to drive a lot of the decisions that we were making about what efforts we needed to be making, you know, what systems we were building and how we were building them. Because when you look at it from the perspective of what's going to actually drive growth in the business, what's going to basically take friction out of the business, rather than just building efficient systems, yeah, it really does mean that you're coming at it from an entirely different perspective.
And it's funny because that conversation for you was happening, I'm trying to track the timeline, what, like six to 8 years ago when you first started talking that way about technology and its relationship to value creation?
It really was right around the time that we started looking at digitization. So this is probably 2013, 2014.
Wow, great.
That we were doing that.
Yeah.
And it's because the organization, so the organization I worked for at the time was an organization that really kind of had a very specific customer focus. Mm-hmm. And even in their mission statement, it was all about how they served their members. And I think a lot of that came from the fact that they were a nonprofit. So not-for-profit organizations tend to be very focused on, you know, who they're serving.
Right. It's interesting that was happening 10 years ago, because I would guess that with the information management industry at large, probably around the same time, started focusing less on compliance and risk as the reason to do information management and more on value creation. And you have this beautiful asset of structured and unstructured data. Like, why wouldn't you use it? And how do we use it in the best way possible to get the best outcomes possible? Do you agree kind of with that shift has sort of happened, where it feels like people are talking more about value as opposed to compliance?
Certainly impacted me, and it certainly changes my focus when I talk to organizations, generally speaking. I think a lot of companies are still very much risk-focused. And especially when you get into compliance organizations, which usually have responsibility for information management, is they're all about managing risk. And they don't necessarily think about, you know, the value that they're really creating for the organization, other than how they're of helping them avoid risk. And to a degree, I think that risk is, you know, I think for many organizations, their sense of what's risky is not necessarily in proportion with the actual risk, you know?
Interesting. So what causes that? Is it they've read something in the media that just scared them, or they have previous experience being fined and it?
I think it is that they're afraid of compliance. Yeah, they're afraid of regulators in a lot of cases. And so they're concerned about regulators coming in, or like, for example, the other thing that happens is that information managers tend to be stuck under the legal part of the organization. So they're very afraid of litigation. And so I think in both of those cases, they tend to be very focused on the risk that's managed by the part of the organization they sit in.
Now, that's something that I never thought about much. Is there a relationship between how an organization perceives the value of information and where an information management practitioner or professional sits in the organization? So when you go into like a client and they're under legal, do you sort of make some initial assumptions about, okay, this is how they're going to perceive this project and this work?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that what you have is, like, in some organizations, okay, you're seeing the creation of a chief data officer office, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think in that case, what happens is that when people start to move, and usually what happens is that the chief data officer, once that position's created, they start taking these other people into their organization. And that changes the entire perspective, mm-hmm. because the chief data officer's largely going to be focused more, they tend to be more focused on how they're creating value for the organization.
So when that happens in an organization and you've had that transformation of mindset where you're focused on the value of data as opposed to the risk, who's managing the hen house? Who's watching the hen house? They're still thinking about compliance and risk, I assume, right? It's someone's still thinking about that.
Certainly are, but it's more of a partnership in that case, because what's happening is that you still are working with those parts of the organization, but I think what happens is the focus shifts a little bit. They still have to be accountable to legal. They still have to be accountable to the compliance part of the organization, but the people who are actually weighing in on those parts of it are now, you know, stakeholders, as opposed to them controlling the entire set of decisions.
Yeah. You know? That's right.
You know, And I think that there's another aspect of that that is typically overlooked in a lot of organizations too, and that's the topic of knowledge management. Because information managers do have a role in helping maintain and manage knowledge within an organization. And so the chief data officer might be more cognizant of that particular need within the organization, because especially because they have probably a better visibility to the business as a whole. And so they understand the problem of information drain due to people coming and going within the organization, for example.
Okay, let's level set for a second, because we may have folks listening to this podcast that haven't been in the industry as long as you. We've just talked about knowledge management, data management, and information management. What are those things, and are they different?
They are. But they're somewhat related in terms of practice, right? Because when we think about information management, what I usually think about is, how are we creating, classifying, and managing, sharing, and finally disposing of content, you know, of information within the organization.
Information being unstructured, right?
So, typically we're talking about unstructured information in documents, right? But so we always talk about the information lifecycle. All information has a lifecycle. And the question is it being managed according to a lifecycle? And what we're seeing is that, like, for example, in the work that we're doing more and more where we're trying to extend some of those information practices into things like applications, you know, where we're actually classifying content in terms of how long it needs to be maintained and managed, but also in terms of how sensitive it might be and how it needs to be protected, you know? And so a lot of what we're seeing is that, you know, in the case of data management and information management, really data management is in a way just a subset of information management as a whole in some degrees. Data management tends to focus on architecture, you know, how you're structuring data. That, you know, the same principles apply that we apply to documents. You don't want outdated information. You don't want duplication and so on. And that's certainly true when it comes to data management too, because what they're typically dealing with is not necessarily the problem of duplication in the source system, but, you know, the downstream impacts of data when you're creating it and starting it connected to other things in the environment. So I don't know that the practices are all that much different when you really think about it in terms of an information lifecycle and what our needs are in terms of protecting information.
And I wonder what your thoughts are, you know, thinking 5-10 years down the line, will those still exist as separate jobs, or will they merge?
I think that you're going to end up with a lot of variations on it from organization to organization, because, you know, companies are different. You know, they have a different set of regulatory requirements. They may have different they may start out with different structures that don't necessarily lend itself to one approach or the other. I think there was a study that was done maybe a year or two ago when they were talking about what's the prevalence of chief data officers in organizations. And what they found was that it's relatively uncommon in organizations. And while it's growing, it's not growing as rapidly as you might expect. So I think the practices are maybe becoming more similar, okay, in terms of what people are really thinking about when it comes to information management. One of the things that was happened at one of the AIM conferences a few years ago. I remember this in, I think, 2020. Okay, was they presented on the need when you're building applications to think about information management, because information management principles apply to systems that you're building, especially if those systems are storing documents, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of overlap there too. In terms of where things are going, what I'm paying a lot of attention to right now is what everybody else is paying attention to, and that's AI, because what we're seeing is a very rapid transformation of many companies due to the fact that now all of these tools are showing up that can really change a lot of the aspects of how they operate. And so I think that's going to have an impact inside of information management. I just am not seeing a lot of it yet. But
Of what you have seen, because this is the question that I get asked a lot, because I say the same thing. It is starting, and we have plenty of IDP providers, ECM providers that have incorporated generative AI functionality into their platforms. But of what you have seen with specifically generative AI in the information management practice, what are some case studies? Have you seen clients actually test it or even successfully deploy it?
Generative AI is only one, one kind of what we're going to call machine learning, because it's all the same thing. But there's so many different ways that you can use machine learning tools in an environment. And so I see generative AI as more of a business-facing benefit so far. Most of the tools that you're seeing are really kind of oriented towards human beings and making people more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm seeing. Microsoft, their first product out of the gate when it came to a dedicated kind of specialized kind of AI is Copilot for Security, which really what that does is it's focused on taking people who are doing threat hunting, which is, dealing with all the various attacks that are happening to enterprises, and basically taking generative AI tools and a number of other types of machine models, and basically collapsing, an investigation that might have taken days a couple of years ago into 10 minutes.
Wow. So
what they're making is they're making companies that can basically, a lot of this stuff that was happening, all of this information gathering that had to take place in order for you to have a picture of the threat, all happens in just a matter of seconds now. And so people are basically focusing on those decisions about the more sophisticated parts of the decision, which is, how seriously should I take this threat? And they can do that because of the fact that now all of that information gathering that literally took them days or hours or days to do happens in almost the blink of an eye.
That's pretty cool.
I think the same things are probably coming, but I think it's a matter of priorities for the vendors who are building these solutions. Where do they think they're going to get the biggest? I think part of it is how big's the marketplace. Part of it is what's the value to the organizations, and where are the greatest needs to apply the technology. One of the things that I'm really kind of hopeful for, is that not only are you getting a lot of these solutions that are being provided to you by vendors now, but the ability to start building your own AI inside of, like, for example, inside of the Microsoft tool set is coming. It's going to be here relatively soon. And in that way, we're going to be able to build very specialized forms of AI models, you know, that are really designed for our businesses. And that's, I think, you know, in the next 1 to 2 years, I think that's going to be a big opportunity for a lot of organizations, is they can take, you know, AI tools that have a very well-developed set of skills, you know, because AI is all about, you know, skill sets, building skill sets. And they can combine them in a variety of different ways to get something that maybe the, you know, the marketplace hasn't thought of yet, but is really well suited for their business model.
Oh, that's fascinating. And I would imagine Microsoft and other vendors, Microsoft in particular, is really good about security and permissions and control. But one of the things that freaks me out when you're telling me about this ability for people to create their own gen AI engines is, if I'm an information manager, I'm responsible for information management for my organization, what do I need to be thinking about there? And I'm sure, like, cybersecurity folks are probably thinking the same thing. Like, what is this safe? What is it? What's happening with the data? How do I control this? How do I mitigate the risk?
So that's actually a lot of what Microsoft is talking about with partners right now, is our organizations, how do organizations actually build their technical readiness for AI? And a lot of that is coming back to information practices that we've been doing for a long time. You know, being able to classify your content, being able to identify where sensitive content might be, being able to label that content so it's appropriately handled by the AI skill, by the AI products, but also so that, like, for example, one of the things that they're doing is they're saying, you know, if I say something's confidential and I, as a business user, ask a question that requires that confidential content, what I generate becomes confidential too. And that's one of those protections that maybe people aren't aware of, but that's going to be part of the landscape, is that, you know, Microsoft is basically creating barriers between your corporate data and public data. They're creating barriers that, you know, they're creating tools that basically are honoring the restrictions that you place on content, the security that you place on content. But, you know, one of those things that you have to be aware of when it comes to technical readiness is, are you basically exposing content within your organization to too many people?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's it's a problem that's been out there for a few years. But I think what happens is, because of the fact that these products can look in across your entire enterprise in terms of what they're gathering information from, then what's happening is that they can also surface content that's inappropriately shared more easily in some ways. So I think organizations have a lot to do in terms of being able to, you know, do the same things that they do for, you know, for the companies, but they have to accelerate the process if they're going to be ready for AI tools to be really used safely in their environments. So it still is about eliminating rot in your environment, you know, get rid of redundant, obsolete, and trivial content that really doesn't matter to the organization and doesn't provide value. And then making sure that you have those classifications in place that allow you to basically isolate sensitive information from the general population and from misuse, in a way, inadvertent misuse by the tools that you're bringing into bear. So I think there's a lot there. Like I said, it's a fast-moving environment. But what I've seen so far in terms of the approach that Microsoft takes to it is that they are very safety-focused in terms of making sure that there's protections built into the products.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a lot that, you know, there's still a lot that clients need to do in order to make sure that their environments are ready for it.
It's sort of like the way you're talking about it, it makes me think of someone shining a spotlight on issues that were already prevalent, but I don't know, maybe it seemed a lot more benign when someone just happened to find how much your CEO was paid on SharePoint and it was accidental. Now it's so incredibly easy to get that data if you weren't careful, if you weren't applying the right tagging and permissions, right?
Right. Well, I think the reason for that is that when you start using these tools, I've been using large language models on a daily basis since Microsoft first started rolling them out. But the value to organizations, again, in having things like ChatGPT or, you know, Copilot for Bing, okay, is that whereas people used to spend sometimes hours trying to find the right information to start their work with,
mm-hmm.
now all of that, you know, the looking around and consolidating the information and then ingesting and organizing and summarizing that information all happens literally at the snap of a finger. Literally speaking, you ask a question to these tools and in most cases you get an answer back in less than 5 seconds. So think about the time savings to organizations. Microsoft did a survey, you know, of people who are using some of the tools that they're making available. And they're finding that people are literally saving, you know, 10 or 20 hours a week, you know.
Yeah.
And 90% of the people who have been given the tools would never want to give them back. So I think that there's things that organizations have to think about in terms of how they're going to use the tools, but I think the focus for Microsoft is all about, you know, how do we assist people and make people more effective?
Yeah. And I think one of the important points that I'm reading between the lines is you've mentioned a couple times where human intervention is absolutely essential to make these tools work. So there is a lot of fear around the digitization of the workforce when you're talking about AI and workforce reduction because of AI. Do you think that that's in the foreseeable future? Do you think workforces are going to be reduced because of AI, or will there still be a need for that human intervention?
I think what happens, you know, I think it depends on who you are and what kind of a business you're operating. You know, if you think about, you know, like something like call centers, AI tools could be used to basically answer simple questions that people might have, as opposed to them having to get somebody on the phone, right? So that's a benefit to the organization. But like, for example, in most organizations, the people that they have in the call centers, there's a lot of turnover there, okay? And so what AI offers to the people in the call centers is the ability for them to be upskilled in some ways, for them to be able to answer questions quicker, okay, and actually be more effective in their jobs. So while that might mean that you need fewer people at the low end, what it also means is that you can basically make those people at the low end more effective in those intermediate roles, you know, in terms. So what you can do is use AI to upskill people and make them more effective in handling more complex kinds of tasks. And I think that that's, I think that's an organizational decision, okay, that many companies are going to have to think about in terms of exactly what's their goal in bringing AI into the organization. Are we trying to make the business better? Okay. As opposed to trying to make more money, for example. I mean, there's two ways to make money, right? You can make more money by basically providing more value, okay? Or you can make more money in the short term by being by cutting costs.
Yeah.
And I think what it does is it allows organizations to repurpose resources and do more with the resources that they have.
I like that. I think
I would vote for that goal. And I think that's the way that Microsoft talks about it.
Yeah.
In terms of why they're building all these tools. We go back to the threat hunting proposition. Most organizations are overwhelmed by threats.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so by making your teams more efficient and upskilling the people who are working in those teams, because now they don't have to learn how to do all this stuff that they used mm-hmm. to have to learn how to do, you basically get a much more responsive organization that makes the company safer.
And what I like about that use case is I do think that one of the first applications of generative AI in an enterprise should be where we lack the human capacity to manage something like threat hunting. I've been an IT director before. It is so many attempts that it is impossible to humanly track on your own. And the same could be said for like big data, large data sets. If it's challenging for a human to manage, I think that's a great opportunity to use artificial intelligence to serve in an assistive role, right? Not replacing me, but helping me manage what was already a really increasingly overwhelming problem.
I absolutely agree with you. I think there's lots of opportunities to make organizations better with AI. And better, by better, I mean they're just more capable, generally speaking.
Yeah.
And I think there's broad applications of it too, because it doesn't, in some cases we talked about, you know, there's very simple, repetitive kinds of tasks that you can automate or you can eliminate the need for people to be involved in them. But then there's still this whole thing about, you know, like making people just better in their jobs. You know, I use AI tools to do research all the time. As a matter of fact, that's one of the transitions that's like I mentioned, I think that's the first kind of transition that you have when it comes to using large language models, is that rather than searching for information, what you're doing is now you're doing knowledge capture. You're basically bringing something back that's, you know, maybe 75% of what you need, okay, very quickly. And so you get to focus on the real, on refinement and those higher skills that humans are still much better than computers at.
Yeah, it's the context that the models and the algorithms are typically missing, right?
Yeah.
You're never going to know
exactly why
I'm asking that prompt, and I can never explain the prompt that well. That, you know, they don't know all the variables that I'm thinking about when I use it.
Well, and there's also still this qualitative problem that you do have, which I think they're getting better at, but you still have the problem with a lot of AI that, depending on how it's trained, it's not going to be able to judge information the way a human can, you know, in terms of whether or not, you know, they talk about this idea of hallucinations, okay? And it's because AI can come across content and not be able to judge, you know, whether or not it's real, whether or not it's accurate or correct, because at the base, what they're good at is tabulating and correlating and judging what's the most likely response to a question. not necessarily what's the most accurate response to a question.
This
So
sounds
people
the best.
still have a big role to play. Huh?
It's what sounds the best. Statistically, we think this is what sounds the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think you've given us some really fantastic insights today. We went in some fascinating directions about, but I think the common thread has honestly been what is that human interaction with AI, and how do humans make AI better and vice versa, which I think is sort of a lovely theme to walk away with. Peter, I want to thank you for being on AIM on Air. This has been a fascinating conversation, and thank you for your membership and being a CIP.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks, Peter.